3. With silent tread, Alastair Crompton proceeded down Primrose Path, as the violet-tinted corridor to Executive Country was called. The rose quartz chalice was gripped firmly in his white hands, and his face was unreadable. At the end of the corridor was a great oaken door upon which was carved a unicorn sniffing a bouquet of spring wildflowers held out by a simpering damsel in a dirndl. This was the coat of arms of Psychosmell, Inc. Beneath it was the proud company motto, adapted from Marshall with a trifle change of one word. Bene olet, qui bene semper olet. Soundlessly, the great doors swung open as Crompton approached. Crompton entered the room. In front of him, arranged in a semicircle, were six armchairs in which were seated the six members of the board. In the center of the semicircle, in an armchair one-third bigger than the others, and raised upon a dais, was the legendary John Blunt, founder of the firm and chairman of the board of directors.
"It's Crompton, is it?" Blunt said in his cracked and quavering voice. "Come forward, Crompton. Let's take a look at you."
John Blunt was old, considering him as a single personality. But from the viewpoint of the average age of his various parts, Blunt was not even middle-aged. Over the years, most of Blunt's vital organs had been repaired or replaced. Even his skin, shining with obscene pinkness, was no more than 10 years old.
His brain was original issue, however, as were his ancient and unfathomable eyes that gleamed incongruously in his firm-fleshed young man's face, like the eyes of a Gila monster poking through a vat of orange jello.
"Well, Crompton, and how have you been?"
Blunt said. The old man's quavering voice issued strangely from the strong young body. Blunt refused to have his voice changed. His hands, too, were original issue. Blunt perversely maintained that he enjoyed being old and had no desire to achieve a spurious youthfulness. He wanted to be old but alive, and did what was necessary to maintain that state.
"I've been fine, sir," Crompton said.
"Glad to hear it, Crompton, glad to hear it. I have followed your career with interest. You have done fine work for this company, my boy. And now you have favored me with another sample of your talents."
"I hope it will please you, sir," Crompton said,
resisting the sudden irrational urge to throw himself at Blunt's feet and grovel abjectly. For this was how the man's presence affected everyone, including Blunt's wife, who had calluses half an inch thick on her knees from following her impulses.
"Well, then, let's get on with it,"
Blunt said, and extended a hand as dry and hard-fleshed as the talons of a Nigerian vulture. Crompton put the quartz bottle in Blunt's hands and stepped back. The founder unstoppered it and delicately sniffed, with his original issue nose, for it was a matter of pride and discretion with him not to tamper with the organ that had made him rich beyond the dreams of avarice.
"Now what have we here?"
he mused aloud, his nostrils flexing strongly to allow the fragrance to distribute itself evenly across his old, leathery, but still sensitive olfactory center. Blunt was silent for a time, head thrown back, nostrils working like tiny twin bellows. Crompton knew that the founder was analyzing the concoction in terms of its primary olfactory qualities, separating and judging the mixture of flowery, fruity, putrid, spicy, burned, and resinous odors. After that, Blunt could be counted upon to estimate the intensity of the various components, measuring them in olfactis, the unit of smell intensity. Only after his analysis was complete would Blunt relax and permit himself to experience the effect of the substance.
"First impressions? Seaside at Point Pleasance, a rosewood bower, desert winds, a child's haunted face, the smell of north wind. Pretty indeed, Crompton. And now the initial rebound effect? Intensification. Sun on salt water, windrows of kelp, silver cliffs, an iron mountain, and the girl, the girl!"
The directors stirred uneasily to hear that vibrant cry torn from the throat of the differentially juvenescent founder. Had Crompton slipped up, perhaps not calculated rotating radical?
"The girl," the founder cried, "the girl in her white lace mantilla. Oh, Nieves, how could I have forgotten you? I see before me now the black waters of Lake Titicaca lapping at the ironwood pilings. That great bird of ill omen, the condor, soars low overhead, and the sun comes from behind massed clouds of purple and pink. You hold my hand, Nieves, you are laughing, you do not know.
The founder fell silent. For an interminable minute, he did not speak. Then he lowered his head. He was back in the present. The vision had faded.
Crompton, he said presently, you have concocted a superb psychic elicitor. I do not know what it will bring to my colleagues, but it has given me a minute of all too rare delight. The memory was false, of course, but its very intensity argues that it must have been true for someone, somewhere. Gentlemen, I declare a double bonus. Crompton, I hereby increase your salary, whatever it is, by 1/3.
Crompton thanked him. As the quartz decanter was passed from hand to hand, he silently left the room, and the great oak door closed silently behind him. The news spread like wildfire throughout the offices of Psycho Smell. Rejoicing was general. Crompton walked soberly back to his chief tester's room. He locked the door behind him and proceeded to straighten up as he did after every working day. Briskly, he sealed the precious substances and put them in the chute that carried them to the vacuum vaults, where they were automatically returned to their hermetic sanctuary. There was only one change in his routine. He took the container of purified essence of Luristia, costliest substance in the galaxy, weight for weight. Tight-lipped, unhesitatingly, he transferred its contents to a plain hermetic flask. He slipped this into his pocket. Then he filled the Luristia container with common oil of Ilang Ilang and returned it to the vault. On his person now were 59 grams of Luristia, the entire produce of 2 years' painstaking hand extraction from the scrawny hypervalidation plants on Alphone 4. Crompton had the equivalent of a medium-sized fortune in his jacket pocket. It was enough to pay his fares to Aaya and Iga. He had crossed his Rubicon, taken the first and irrevocable step toward reintegration. He was on his way, if only he could get away with it.